Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Let's do it again. It's time to learn and improve your American English. Today, we travel to New York to visit with some famous mountain climbers. They are still sad about losing some of their own recently in a faraway land. Then, we travel to the southwestern United States to learn about the work of a man who built some of the most famous buildings in America. As It Is, on the internet, on television, and on radio, is on the air. Sherpas continue to mourn the 16 mountain guides who died in an avalanche on Mount Everest. The avalanche, or snowslide, overpowered and killed the guides on April 18th. At the time, the group was preparing a path so that Westerners could climb the world's highest mountain. New York City is home to the largest Sherpa community outside Nepal. VOA's Adam Phillips is in New York, and Christopher Cruz has his report.
The New York neighborhood of Elmhurst, Queens, is home to an estimated 3,500 Sherpas. Many of them were busy at work last Saturday. They were preparing for a community-wide memorial service in the Buddhist Center at the headquarters of the United Sherpa Association. Ang Gelgen Sherpa, a Nepalese-American, is head of the association.
New York is a busy life, but yet we keep in touch with our community back home. And we are all connected through emails or through phones. So people knew these people, and most of them were brought up there around the Everest region. So definitely, the feeling was more sorrow.
Ang Gelgen Sherpa is pleased with his people's tradition of safely guiding climbers, usually from the west, up Mount Everest. Many climb to the nearly 9,000-meter-high summit, the highest point on the mountain's surface.
And the climbers who go up the mountain, they know that the risk factor is there. Every year people get killed on the mountain. Still, they're willing to take these risks because they have to put food on the table. Of course, the safety concern is it's very important. But you can't do nothing about the avalanches.
However, one can do safer work, even if it is far less profitable than guiding groups up the mountain and carrying their equipment. That is what Pasang Kangchi Sherpa told her brother before he died in the accident. Many years earlier, her other brother was also killed there. Nangwang Dongdup is a Buddhist religious worker, or monk. He saw Pasang Kangchi Sherpa crying all during the 8-hour traditional funeral ceremony for her brother. The monk had both an emotional reaction and a spiritual explanation.
It's really sad that it happened there, but people have to die. It's because of their karma. According to Buddhism, that when people die, they will burn again in a good place. So you just have to pray for them.
Karma is said to be the force created by a person's actions. Some people believe it causes good or bad things to happen to that person. United Sherpa Association President Ang Gelgen Sherpa says it was not only karma that brought death to those Sherpas on Mount Everest, it was economic reasons and few other choices.
That's why, we are in America. We have to tell our kids. We have to focus on education. We have to break the cycle of climbing.
He hopes Sherpas will learn to strike a balance between the traditions of the past and present-day safety concerns on the world's tallest mountain. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Frank Lloyd Wright, has been called the father of modern American architecture. Wright designed hundreds of buildings and other structures during his lifetime. He died in 1959. The grand expanse of his designs can be seen at two historic properties in the western state of Arizona. One is Taliesin West. It served as Wright's winter home and architecture school. And just a short drive from the property is a Wright-influenced hotel. Katie Weaver serves as our guide.
The sound of water hitting the ground is unusual in the dry sagebrush foothills that surround Taliesin West. But the water comes from a fountain operating on the grounds. Frank Lloyd Wright began work on this 200-hectare property in 1939. The buildings include an airy theater for live performances, an underground kiva for watching movies, and the place where Wright lived until his death. Guide Mark Coriel leads visitors toward the office where Wright met with people from around the world.
Yeah. This way, we're going to head on in.
Tall visitors must bend down so they do not hit their heads against Wright's low doorways. They can stand up again in his office. The room is built of native stone. It also has high ceilings that seem to float because they are clear enough to let light pass through. Mark Coriel says Wright was able to create this effect by using simple canvas cloth.
Mr. Wright, I'm always kind of felt they were camping out here in the desert.
This camp includes windows placed so high that only the desert sky can be seen. One visitor notes the sharp difference between the blue sky and the floors, which Wright painted a bright Chinese red.
And the colors are just everything so nice out here.
During the 1930s, most American architects liked to design buildings with traditional white columns. These tall supports were often added to straight, traditional-looking buildings, surrounded by orderly green lawns. The columns at Taliesin West are not straight. They slant, creating surprising images as the sun travels across the sky. The stone walls mix well with the native plants and desert trees. Visitors say they really like Wright's ideas.
He's uniquely American, and he wanted to break from us just copying other cultures like we did in Washington. Beautiful, obviously, but it's not unique. So that's really one of the legacies.
So I have a niece and a nephew that are both young architects. They're all drawn to those that came before. It's the continuity of history, and I love it.
To keep that continuity, the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation spends over $1 million a year on Taliesin West. The group also directs the architecture school on the property. Only 30 minutes from Taliesin West is another building Frank Lloyd Wright would like. The Arizona Biltmore Hotel rises like the official home of a great leader. It was designed by one of Wright's students, but the famous architect offered suggestions for creating the hotel's beautiful walls. They are made from concrete Biltmore blocks that include palm frond designs. Details like these have persuaded presidents, movie stars, and others to visit the Biltmore, even today. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington.
From the dangers of climbing the world's highest mountain to learning about America's most famous builder, you never know what to expect when you listen to As It Is on VOA.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. African educators and civil society group members gathered recently to discuss the United Nations Millennium Development Goals on education. They said a UN report shows progress, but they also said some countries cannot meet the goals by the targeted date next year. The educators and other experts said those countries cannot increase education and gain equal treatment for boys and girls in schools by 2015. They noted that this is especially true of sub-Saharan nations. The meeting in Yaoundé, Cameroon, included experts from 43 African countries. Jean-Pierre Edzoa is an official of Cameroon's Ministry of Social Affairs. He describes the life ahead for uneducated children as a disaster. He says the government is doing everything possible to make parents understand that they harm their children if they do not send them to school. The World Wildlife Fund for Nature is best known for its work for the environment, but it is also helping efforts to increase school attendance. Hansen Ngefordi is director of the WWF office in Cameroon. He said it is now centering its efforts on education because so many children do not go to school. That sound invites Baka and Embaroro ethnic groups in Central Africa to send their children to school. They still live the traditional lives of their groups, and official education is not of top importance for them. Mr. Ngefordi notes that the Baka people have been asked for their ideas about how to get children into schoolrooms. Boy Raruku is with the group Africa Network Campaign on Education for All. He says the meeting in Yaoundé provided a chance to look to the future.
The sustainable development goals that civil society has been pushing for is that beyond 2015, before 2015, the world leaders did commit to Millennium Development Goals, which were to be achieved by 2015. So a number of the goals that they committed to are coming to an end in 2015. Beyond 2015, what should it be like?
Beatrice Njenga heads the Education Division at the African Union Commission. She says educators are preparing a 50-year education program for Africa. She says they need financial help and central planning.
If you want to support Africa, you need to understand Africa's very well articulated vision as the priorities in education for 2063, so that all investment is towards a common vision. So unless you actually sit and put in place strategies to achieve what we need to achieve in 50 years, it will be 2063 and we'll be still talking about the same thing.
The education experts reported some good news. They said rates of poverty have been decreasing and more children are in school. And that's the Education Report from VOA Learning English. I'm Geraldine Watson.
¶¶ from VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. Last week on our program, we talked about the presidency of John Tyler. The future of Texas was a major issue in American politics in the early 1840s. Texas had declared its independence from Mexico in 1836. Now some Americans wanted the new Republic of Texas to become a U.S. state. But others wanted Texas to remain independent. The Republic of Texas permitted slavery. Americans who opposed Texas statehood wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler wanted to make Texas a state. Tyler was a Southerner. He supported slavery and wanted Texas to keep the system legal. The president also had political reasons for wanting Texas to join the Union. He wanted to show that he increased the size and power of the United States during his presidency. He hoped Texas statehood would win him a nomination for a second term as president. So Tyler asked his new Secretary of State, John C. Calhoun, to negotiate the annexation of Texas. On April 12, 1844, Calhoun and Texas officials agreed the territory would enter the Union. They said the new state of Texas could continue slavery. But Britain objected. A British official sent a note saying that Britain wished to end slavery wherever it existed, including Texas. Secretary Calhoun's reply to Britain went public. He defended slavery in the American South. He said what was called slavery was really a political institution necessary for the peace, safety, and economic strength of those states where it existed. Ending slavery in Texas, he said, would be a danger to the American South and to the Union itself. Many people in northern states rejected Calhoun's reasoning. They called on their senators to vote against accepting Texas. But President Tyler continued with his effort to take control of Texas. He sent Calhoun's agreement with Texas to the U.S. Senate for approval. Soon after, the Whig Party opened its national convention to nominate a candidate for president. As expected, the Whigs did not choose President Tyler. They nominated Senator Henry Clay instead. Clay had been working hard to win the nomination. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention a month later. Many Democrats wanted former President Martin Van Buren to be their candidate. But the convention took a surprising turn. The Democrats approved a rule that a candidate must receive at least two-thirds of the votes to win. In the first vote, Van Buren won the most support, but not two-thirds. The convention delegates voted again, and again Van Buren fell short. The delegates kept voting, but Van Buren never earned the number of votes he needed. In fact, Van Buren began to lose votes. Other candidates were suggested, but none of them seemed able to win the necessary two-thirds either. Finally, someone proposed a new name, James Knox Polk.
James Polk was a very fascinating man, very hardworking, relentless in his pursuit of goals. He was not a particularly likable human being. He was somewhat suspicious of other people, but he had a way of figuring out what he needed to do to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish, and he was very good at it, and that served him very well throughout his life.
Historian Robert Merry wrote a book about James K. Polk. Mr. Merry says Polk did not come to the 1844 convention expecting to be nominated for president. At the time, Polk's political career was struggling. He had already served as the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and the Governor of Tennessee. He was well respected and serious. But Polk had lost in his attempts to seek re-election as governor not once, but twice. Polk came to the Democrats' convention hoping to re-enter national politics and perhaps win the nomination for vice president. When the convention delegates voted on their presidential candidate for the eighth time, Polk received only 44 votes. Then the delegates voted again. This time, Polk received all 266 votes. Historian Robert Merry says James K. Polk became the first real political dark horse in American history. In other words, he was someone no one thought would win. One reason he did was Texas. Polk wanted to make Texas a state. He thought the United States could take possession of the area peacefully. The other leading Democratic candidate, Martin Van Buren, did not think so. Neither did the Whig candidate, Henry Clay. Van Buren and Clay believed that annexation of Texas could lead to a war with Mexico, and they were afraid that if Texas were to become a state, Americans would clash again over the issue of slavery. So, Robert Merry says, both Martin Van Buren and Henry Clay spoke against bringing Texas into the Union.
And that was probably the right position from a standpoint of prudence, political prudence, or maybe diplomatic prudence. But it was the wrong position from the standpoint of where the American people were politically at that time.
In the 1840s, many Americans liked the idea of expanding the country. They believed in manifest destiny, the idea that God wanted America to expand west all the way to the Pacific Ocean and dominate the continent.
It's a very powerful concept, and it was not just a powerful concept, but it was a powerful impulse of America at that time.
As a result, Robert Merry says, many voters supported James K. Polk and his promise to add Texas to the United States. Polk took another unusual position in the 1844 election. He said if he won the presidency, he would serve only one term, that is, 4 years. Polk told voters he did not believe the federal government should have too much power. He said presidents and other elected officials might abuse their power if they held office too long. One term, he said, would be enough for him. But historian Robert Merry says there was more to Polk's one-term promise. After all, two presidents Polk admired, Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson, had each served 2 terms. The nation's first president, George Washington, had also served 2 terms. Robert Merry says Polk's one-term promise was also a political bet. Polk wanted other Democratic politicians to support him. Polk thought that if he said he would be president for only 1 term, other politicians might help him win. Then those politicians could try again to win the presidency in 4 years instead of waiting 8.
And I suspect that he was probably right, and given the closeness of the election, I suspect that had he not made that one-term promise, he very likely would have been beaten by Clay.
As it was, the election of 1844 was extremely close. Wild campaign charges were made against both candidates. The Whig candidate, Henry Clay, was called a gambler, a duelist, a man of dishonest deals. Stories were told about his use of strong language and love of card games. On the other side, Whig newspapers reported that someone saw a group of slaves being sold in Tennessee. Burned into the skin of each slave, the papers said, were the letters JKP, the initials of James K. Polk. In the autumn of 1844, 2,700,000 Americans elected a new president. Polk defeated Clay by only about 38,000 votes nationwide. But Polk won 170 electoral votes to Clay's 105. President Tyler believed Polk's victory showed the American people wanted Texas to become a state. When Congress met in December, he proposed that both the House of Representatives and the Senate resolve to give Texas statehood. In a few months, they did. President Tyler signed the resolution on March 1, 1845, just 3 days before he left office. The resolution invited Texas to join the Union as a state. It gave Texas the right to split into as many as 4 more states when its population was large enough. Texas could keep its public lands, but it had to pay its own debts. And Texas could enter the Union as a slave state. The Mexican minister to the U.S. objected to the resolution. Mexico did not recognize Texas as an independent territory. The minister said making Texas an American state was an act of aggression against his country. He demanded his passport and returned to Mexico. Britain and France also sought to prevent Texas from becoming a state. They persuaded Mexico to agree to recognize Texas independence, but only if Texas would not join the United States. Texas thus had 2 choices. It could join the United States, or it could continue as a republic with its independence recognized by Mexico. The Texas Congress chose statehood. But the choice would come with a cost. The war between Mexico and the United States will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.